Coming up, the archaeology that's at risk of disappearing completely at a Bronze Age site of worldwide importance.
We must do something about it now, while it's still there, and I'm afraid it's rapidly deteriorating.
The internet's self-confessed word nerd Rob Words on how etymology can reveal the history of the past.
And I'm back with more archaeology stories in Time Team News.
It's all here on the Time Team podcast.
Hello and welcome once again to another edition of the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geek. And Helen, I need to start by congratulating you on the first two episodes of the Certain Who Dig, all available to watch on YouTube. They were brilliant.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it sometimes when you see them, you think, gosh, it's all felt a lot more chaotic than that. And how on earth did such a good story come out of every day, which was a bit of a jumble, really? You realise that what actually happened only when you look at the programmes. We've got the last one coming out on Saturday, which is a really good time to get the final one out in front of the public, because we are returning to Sutton Hoo in just a few weeks, in the middle of May. So we need to be sharpening up our ideas for exactly what we need to get out of the next and the final year of excavation there.
Yeah, and because this episode of the podcast is available to watch on YouTube as well as listen to, I should mention that the next time that you see us, so our next YouTube edition, which is in about 4 weeks' time, will be on site and taking you behind the scenes as our 2025 dig at Sutton Hoo will be in full swing.
And that's going to be a really exciting moment, because we have learnt so much from last year's excavation. We should be able to just swing into action in 2025, in just a few weeks, and know exactly what levels we're going to, what we expect to see under the topsoil, under the turf, through the topsoil and into the subsoil. We should be able to get be much more efficient than we were last year. So what we get out of it is going to be that much more extraordinary.
Well, from one world-renowned archaeological site to another, because on this episode of the podcast, we're taking you to Flag Fen, the Bronze Age site discovered near Peterborough in East Anglia back in 1982 by Time Team's Francis Pryor. And if you're a real Time Team aficionado, you'll probably know it, because we've done an excavation there and at nearby Must Farm as well back in the, I think it was the late 90s.
Now, Flag Fen is important because it is one of the largest known Bronze Age archaeological sites in Europe. It is absolutely massive, all made of wood. It's this huge, long, kilometre-long alignment of posts making a causeway out into the fen and ending in a ginormous 2-hectare wooden platform. So 2 hectares is, what, 5 acres. And that platform is absolutely crammed full of perfectly preserved wooden structure, and also the most remarkable and amazing finds.
Yeah, it is an amazing sight. But Flag Fen is in trouble, though, quite serious trouble, actually. And you'll learn more about why that is a little bit later on. First, though, I want to get you acquainted with the place and how it's bringing the past back to life. And so I got in touch with Francis Pryor, and he agreed to revisit the site that he discovered all those years ago.
Welcome to Flag Fen. And we're now walking down the Roman road that runs across the centre of the site and which we excavated with Time Team over 20 years ago. Over to our left, you can see a row of posts. That's a reconstruction of the causeway that was built here 1,000 years before the Romans built this road. And behind, you can see the outline of round houses. Those are Bronze Age round houses that we have reconstructed based on evidence excavated from the ground.
Well, I wanted to meet some of the volunteers using ancient techniques to bring this roundhouse reconstruction to life.
We're daubing. It's something I've never done before, so it's been a bit of volunteering work. I'm really, really enjoying it.
I've been wanting to learn a new skill. And this is my new skill for this year, daubing and wattling.
Some people have been slightly more erratic than others, so I'm just trying to get a decent finish, because it needs to have a continuous kind of finish. It'll probably take about 3 or 4 days to dry out. Now I'm a grown-up, I've retired grown up. I can go back to playing mud without getting told off.
Right, what we're doing here, we're mixing up the door bin with soil, straw and some of the sheep that have kindly left their belongings in the field, which is now going to be put on the walls in the roundhouse. It'll be something nice.
Go through that. Through the layers that we've done previously in this case.
My name's Arthur, I'm helping with the roundhouse. At the moment I'm just doing a bit of thatching. First thing we do is we actually make them into these small bundles called yelms, and you just make sure they're the right sort of size to go on the roof. If you make them too small, you end up doing tons of these. If you make them too big, because the reed is actually tempered at the top, you'll find that they start to go triangular and then they'll slip out. But once we've made those, we can just move them into place, give it a bit of tap down, make sure we're filling in all those gaps, have a tighten, and then we just reset our knot for the next time.
Well, this roundhouse is still under construction, but I was keen to understand a bit more about what life might have been like in one. So Francis gave me the tour of a structure that was put up several decades ago.
It would have been very carefully organised. The main person in the family would have sat in the chair opposite the front door, the only door. And when new people were coming to meet the family, they would have had to have paid their respect to that person. There was a hearth, a fire, in the centre of the building, but there wasn't a chimney, so the smoke filtered out through the thatch. The central fireplace was where they cooked food and warmed their hands, and it was the centre of the building. This would have been a house for a family. So maybe, let's say you had a family of four or six children, so 8-10 people would have lived here. But, on occasion they'd have had family get-togethers, which would have been much more crowded. Round houses in Britain all have their doorways pointing in more or less the same direction. That's right across the country. People knew how to organise and how to build a round house, and they were clearly very highly organised spaces. We've got a fire, so what do fires produce? They produce smoke, and we know that in the fens around here they caught sturgeon, and they would have hung in the roof. And what does a smoked sturgeon produce? Caviar. So what did they eat in the Iron Age? Caviar. Was life in the Iron Age miserable? No, I don't think so. I'd have loved lots of free caviar.
Well, that's Francis all over. He doesn't really need much in the way of creature comforts, but he does love a good dinner.
And caviar as well. I had no idea that people in, ancient times would have been having caviar.
Yeah, well, every bit of the fish. I mean, I don't think that Francis would say no to a nice bit of grilled sturgeon, but he'd definitely have loved the caviar.
Good. Well, there we go. You learn something new. Back to Flag Fen, by the way, in just a little bit. I mentioned, and you're going to be learning more on this podcast, a major, major threat is facing that site, and you'll find out why later on in the podcast.
This is the Time Team podcast. We're here on YouTube this week, but don't forget we've got brand new episodes every Tuesday, which you can hear wherever you get your podcasts from. Each week, I answer questions that you've submitted about archaeology on Patreon, which I'll be doing later on in this episode. There was a question that came in from Michael, though, which really got me thinking. Michael asked, do archaeologists ever look for clues in language? Now, the answer I gave was yes, but I wanted to get a bit more information about this because although I am obsessed with words, I am not an expert, and I wanted to know more about the subject.
So let's bring in one of the internet's leading word nerds. That's his term, by the way, not mine. Rob Watts is from the Language and Etymology YouTube channel, Rob Words, and his videos explore the words that we use and where they come from, how they've shaped the world that we live in. And Rob, so many people in the comments suggested that Helen and I check out your channel, and I thought we might want to dive a little deeper into this subject.
Great. I'm glad to have an army of wordy, nerdy evangelists fighting my corner.
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons that I love etymology and the history of words so much is that archaeologists get so little of language. We just don't encounter it much. And so we get completely entranced by little objects that do have inscriptions on them. But even though I am a bit obsessed about it, what I'd not thought about until Michael's question is that etymology is kind of the archaeology of speech, isn't it? Can it tell us much about how people lived in the past?
Absolutely. I mean, the history of these islands, of the British Isles, is writ large in our language. And you can, just by looking at the words we say every day, you can trace things like, you know, the arrival of the Vikings. You can trace things like, obviously, the Anglo-Saxons. You can trace the invention of the printing press. It's all there in the language. But what can it tell us about, yeah, how people lived? Well, if you look at Old English, or Anglo-Saxon as it was commonly called, we tend to call it Old English now, but it's the language of the Anglo-Saxons, you can see that there are words in there that we don't use anymore, but give us an insight into what they were up to, basically. And there are obvious things like objects and this and that, but also things like values. For example, the Anglo-Saxon had lots of words relating to friendship. Friendship was clearly very important to them. They did have the word friendship as well. They also had an opposite of it that we don't have, which was fionnskip, which meant enemy ship. But they also had words like winnetre, or winne is the Old English for a friend, and winnetre means friend trust or friend faith, which I really like. They also had words like you could have a sundorwinne, which was a special friend. And they also had this beautiful other word, which is winne yemor, which means the sorrow you feel at the loss of a friend. But there are also things that they clearly enjoyed. And one of those is mead. They have all kinds of words for things associated with mead. They had this word medudrem, which is mead glee, which is the sort of joy that you have with friends. You know, people talk about that word hygge, that Danish word, you know, which we don't have a translation for, but medudrem was a very similar idea. And the enjoyment of the mead hall, they had the word mead hall as well, where you would sit on a mead seat or a mead bench, and you would enjoy this drink that was clearly very important to them, as well as their beloved ale.
So at what point then do we start speaking something that we would be able to identify as English and we would actually be able to understand now?
Geography is what dictates when English starts, because it is the arrival of the West Germanic dialects that the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes and these groups are speaking, arrives on the island of Britain, that we get something that you can call English, because it's all of a sudden isolated from the other West Germanic dialects that go on to become Dutch, Frisian, German, Low German, High German, all of those. It becomes isolated from that and becomes its own thing, starts to take on its own form. And those groups, the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, they are speaking their own dialects, but they're very similar. That language, that collection of languages starts to, you know, form into, coalesce into its own language, fully fledged, that we call Old English or Anglo-Saxon. They come, they spread out, their language replaces what was here before, and we get Old English, and that is the birth of English.
I hear everything you say, and I don't want to sound like I'm nitpicking. But,
but you're going to.
But I'm going to, yes.
Pick a nit,
because,
go on.
Because I think the nit that I'm going to pick is that you just said, that, well, the language replaces it. But if you look at the Norman Conquest, you get a whole load of conquerors coming over and conquering us, called things like William the Conqueror, and bringing new words. But they don't change the structure of the language. And as I understand it, Old English has got hardly any of that kind of substratum of Welsh or Latin. How did, this is one of the big questions of Anglo-Saxon studies, how did a Germanic language overtake something? What were we speaking before? And how did it completely vanish?
And you've said it's one of the big questions, and that is what it is. We don't know why the language that is being spoken in Britain before the Angles and Saxons arrive, for some reason, is pushed exclusively to the Western excesses of Britain.
you get an emotional connection, don't you, when you can hear the language that somebody would have been speaking. And I just wonder, because when I think Romans, I think Latin. But would people here have been speaking Latin?
Roman Britain had a sort of highland region and a lowland region. And the highland region, yes, it includes sort of bits of Scotland, but really that is along the west as well. And then the lowland region is the south and the east. And in the south and the east, which is kind of the what you might call the civilized part of Roman Britain, something called British Latin is being spoken. It's a vulgar Latin, right? So it's not classical Latin, much like the Latins that become French, Portuguese, Spanish on the continent. It is, yeah, it's something different to classical Latin, but it's British, it's its own. And then in the Highland region, which is sometimes called the military zone, that wasn't so much the case, because the Latin that was being spoken in the civilized area was being spoken by townspeople, but sort of, you know, higher class townspeople. Whereas in the military zone, where the Romans were a little less interested in settlement, I suppose, this Brittonic or Brythonic Celtic language appears to have been what was mostly being spoken around there. The problem we have, though, is that it doesn't seem like this Celtic was being written down. So we don't have evidence of that. But British Latin was being written down. There aren't a lot of examples of it, or written down, carved into things as well, which we're particularly interested in as you know, archaeology fans. But there are only a few thousand examples.
A few thousand?
Yeah, but there are, yes.
Aren't they all gravestones? Don't they just say, here lies somebody?
That's what the Romans liked to do, isn't it? It's not just gravestones, but they liked to carve things exalting themselves onto things, didn't they? And those are the sort of things that we have found. And there are minor sort of variations in spelling. Things aren't necessarily spelt the way you might expect them to be spelt in the Latin. And, you know, that's a hint at maybe that this is a specific British Latin that is written on this thing. But we don't know a lot about it.
Just the fact that we know that there's something different about British Latin, and in another world, we might have been speaking a Romance language that isn't French, that isn't Portuguese. That's quite extraordinary.
You took the words right out of my mouth with that, Helen. It's the idea that we would have our own Romance language.
Yeah.
I say that we would be speaking, although we wouldn't exist if the Angles and Saxons hadn't done their thing, I suppose.
We talked a bit about how etymology can inform archaeology, but what about the other way round? How much of the things that we are finding now under the ground is still shaping, to this day, our understanding of the languages that we would have been speaking?
Well, what we were just saying about British Latin and the fact that we're trying to piece it together from bits and bobs that we find tells you exactly, you know, how important archaeology is to language. And our understanding of, you know, everything before we could record people saying things out loud has to come from artifacts, doesn't it? So the more we find, the more we learn.
Rob, that is just amazing. I could talk to you forever, but I know you have other things to do, and I must let you go.
I'm
amazed that Martin hasn't stopped me before now. But I think what we're going to do is put an extended chat with Rob up on our Patreon. So if you support us at patreon.com/timeteamofficial, then you'll be able to learn even more about how etymology and language can inform archaeology and history and all sorts of ways of understanding the past.
Yeah, and while you're there, you can also check out the bonus content that is on offer to Patreon supporters. That's including an exclusive masterclass with Naomi Supal on the flotation technique that she uses. That's really interesting. There's a chance to volunteer at a dig. There's behind-the-scenes videos and so much more. And by the way, just independently of all of that, may I recommend subscribing to Rob on YouTube. His channel is called Rob Words.
Back to Flag Fen shortly to find out why the archaeology there could be lost forever. Plus, I'll be answering more of your questions. But first, though, it's time to catch up with Danny. Danny Wooten, who's here with Time Team News. Hi, Danny.
Thanks, Helen. Well, our first story takes us to Cumbria in northern England, where some remarkable wall paintings dating to the 1500s have been discovered in a former Tudor hunting lodge called the Ashes. Now, while some paintings were found already on the ground and the first floors, these newly discovered paintings were found during recent work in the principal bedroom, and they've been made using a technique called stucco, which is a way of applying pigments to dried plaster. They're painted in the grotesque style, so there are fantastical beasts and swirly foliage decorations, and there are animals depicted. There's a dog's head and a running hare. On advice from Historic England, the paintings have been given special protection, which is part of the building's Grade 2-star listed status. The building's owners, Jen and Richard Arkell, said, "Removing old failing plaster to find these remarkable motifs and faces looking back at us is a moment we will never forget." Our next two stories, by coincidence, take us to southern Germany. Firstly, a recent study published in the Journal of Osteoarchaeology re-examined a 2,500-year-old skeleton that was discovered in the central mound of an Iron Age hill fort in Hüneburg. Now, the skeleton had been excavated decades before by archaeologists, but recently when it was re-examined, researchers noticed a wound on the ischial bone, which is part of the pelvis near the hip joint. So the researchers conducted a 3D CT scan, and they were able to make a negative imprint of the wound. And from this, they were able to ascertain that the wound had been caused by a small arrowhead, probably coming from front left, while the person was running, sitting, or riding. Remarkably, the injury shows signs of healing, which demonstrates that the person received medical care and that the arrowhead was expertly removed with specialist implements. The person must have been regarded with some importance when he died, because he received a princely burial in the centre of the hill fort. Staying in southern Germany, over 100 horse skeletons have been discovered close to a Roman fort near Stuttgart. Now, it's thought that the horses are associated with the military, because it's known that there was a 500-strong cavalry unit situated at the fort between 100 and 150 AD. The horses were buried on their sides with their legs either crouched or outstretched in shallow pits. Now, this is a really interesting assemblage for the researchers because it's so large, and they're going to be able to examine all kinds of things such as the gender and the age, the cause of death, perhaps even what the horses were eating and where the original herd came from. Now, I mentioned that the horses have been buried in shallow pits without much ceremony, but there's one equine exception, because this horse was buried with two jugs and a small Roman oil lamp carefully tucked into the crook of its leg. Sarah Roth, one of the principal archaeologists on the excavation, said, "Even after some 1,800 years, the grief over the death of this one animal is still evident." And that's it for now, but I'll be back soon with more Time Team news.
Thank you, Danny.
Earlier on in this episode, you heard from Francis Pryor at Flag Fen in East Anglia, the Bronze Age site that's home to roundhouses and an ancient causeway.
Flag Fen is under threat, though, and the archaeology there could be lost forever, as Francis has been explaining.
It's arguably the best preserved prehistoric landscape, certainly in Britain and quite possibly in Northern Europe. I was sliding along the drain behind me and I saw bits of wood sticking out of the mud. The axe marks were very clear and we knew they came from a late Bronze Age axe, so it's a Bronze Age site. And what we've done here is that we've reconstructed it as it would have looked 3,000 years ago.
There's so much incredible archaeology here at Flag Fen, but it's under threat. Look at the ground here. It's cracked, it's dried out, and that shouldn't be the case at all. There's plenty of sources of water here. So what's being done to try to stop that from happening?
So we're now standing on the edge of the Flag Fen Mere. We constructed it in an effort to keep the archaeology deeply buried beneath our feet now, to keep it wet. When we did it, we thought this would preserve it forever, but subsequent research has shown that actually it is now starting to deteriorate. There is no way that there'll be any wood out here in Flag Fen in 100 years' time. It will all have gone. We can't afford to just leave it for another 10 years and then do something about it. We must do something about it now while it's still there, and I'm afraid it's rapidly deteriorating.
I'm walking along a replica of the causeway that Francis discovered here many decades ago, and it would have been such an impressive structure, over a kilometre in length from end to end. And look at these posts here that would have stood right the way along this structure. They've been doing work to try and preserve the original of this, and it's been taking place in that building behind me.
It's very difficult to see Bronze Age remains, but here we've got them preserved. Everything you can see down there is as it was left 3,000 years ago. And our aim is to preserve it by keeping it wet. That's why we have all the hose pipes, and we have the iron walls which are keeping the water in, so that this little part of Flag Fen will be preserved for much longer than the landscape outside.
The worry, though, is knowledge of this ancient landscape painted on the walls here could be lost forever if the archaeology dries out. And even this impressive preservation work might not be enough to save it.
We know that the ancient wood is deteriorating quite fast. So we've got to do something to excavate it and record what is there now so that we can tell people in the future. And to do this, we're putting together a major research project. And the person to tell you about that is Jackie Mooney, who is the manager at Flag Fen and who's making a lot of the plans.
We're busy working with Cambridge University and Historic England to develop a new research framework. That framework will identify which parts of the causeway we need to excavate first, whilst there's still organic material there to be tested, and what the really important questions are that we still need to answer. What did the causeway look like? How big was it? We're in for a really exciting 5 years where we do a lot of research, a lot of training, and have loads of fun.
Well, this is more or less where I found Flag Fen back in 1982. 50 years later, I now realise, and I think we're all beginning to realise, that Flag Fen is a lot more than just about posts and wood. It's about how people live their lives in the Bronze Age and why people live their lives. I think Flag Fen has hugely enriched our perception of the past, and that has enriched our perception of ourselves.
Flag Fen is a really remarkable site, and it's not just because it is so big and it is so old, but it's because the preservation is so incredible. We can see more from Flag Fen than we can from really almost anywhere else. But the really sad thing about what's happening there is that it's not just Flag Fen, it's mirrored at all sorts of other enormous waterlogged sites, like famously the Mesolithic site at Starcar in Yorkshire. And this is all happening because our modern ways of life are just not conducive to the preservation of waterlogged, wet, liminal places. We like to dry them out and use them for agriculture, and that is so bad for the archaeology. The preservation of these sites is something that we've got to get to grips with, and my view is that we should be thinking perhaps less about trying to preserve them. Maybe that's impossible. What we should be trying to do is trying to understand them now, quickly, before they disappear. And that means throwing money not into their literal preservation, but into their preservation by record, their replacement by a record. What I feel we should be doing is we should be excavating and quickly and doing a really imaginative project, which could include the community around Flag Fen now.
And that's exactly what they are trying to do at Flag Fen. And maybe we should be mirroring that approach at other sites across the country to get to that archaeology before it disappears forever. I should say, by the way, this is a message to you as well. If you've never been to Flag Fen before, it is such an interesting site. If you're a lover of archaeology, it's a sort of must-visit place. Go now before it's lost forever.
This is the Time Team podcast, and we are now weekly. So make sure you follow us wherever you get your podcasts, because a new episode comes out every Tuesday.
And on every single episode, we feature your questions, and these come in from people who support us on Patreon. And you can do that now by going to patreon.com/timeteamofficial. There's a new place actually now to ask your question. It was getting a bit, I think, complicated and awkward trying to find the right post to comment on. So we've come up with a new way of doing it. You'll find a chat on Patreon. I think it's in the community section. It's just called, you know, questions for the podcast, really easily labeled there. Join in that conversation, and that is where you can ask your question. Let's go to the questions now. There's been loads that have come in for this episode, so it's really difficult to find sort of the best ones to ask. So sorry if you asked a question and you don't hear it asked here. We do try and get through as many of them as we can. This one comes in from Heather, who says, is a test pit more than simply a little trench? This is interesting because we hear a lot about test pits, don't we, and what they might be used for. Does it have a special research purpose, and is it excavated or recorded differently? How do you decide when to use test pits versus bigger trenches? So let's just explain then, Helen, what is a test pit?
A test pit, it's really less than a little trench. It's when you can't really call it a trench anymore because it's become so small. And they are done for completely different things, really. You're looking firstly for fines recovery, and secondly, you're looking at the soils. You're looking at trying to reconstruct how the soils vary across a site. So you can dig a lot of test pits. You can cover a much bigger area than you could with just one big trench. You can ask specific questions. So the question that Corenza has been asking for years with her test pit project is, how does the pottery vary across a village? What can you say about the development of a village using a test pit, where you could never dig trenches because the settlement, the current settlement, the currently occupied settlement, is in the way? So she looks at fines. What we have been doing at Sutton Hoo is, yes, we've been interested in the fines, but we've been more interested in how the natural deposits vary across the site, which is why we put them in a straight line at regular intervals to see what was going on here, there, and everywhere. Each test pit project is individual and individually designed, but they're not really little trenches. They don't replace trenches. They augment them, and they answer different questions.
Because I think I had in my head the idea that you do a little hole first, and then if you see something you like, you make it bigger and you turn it into a real trench. But actually, they serve a different purpose.
Yeah, no, you can't do that. That's a really good question, Martin, because you can't do that because they are a statistical sample. So when Paul Blinkhorn, the pottery specialist, looks at each test pit that Carenza has done, he will see how much pottery has come out from a metre square, as much as what kind of pottery it is. So they need to be 1 metre square, no more, no less.
So if you were doing a test pit, but you had plans to do a trench at some point in the future, would you then have to make sure that your test pit was far enough away from where you were planning to put a trench that the two couldn't sort of intersect?
I think that I probably would, yes. I think that the test pit will, I mean, it's not a cost-free technique. If you think you're going to want to excavate something that you can see, say, in geophysics, in a more detailed way, then put your test pit somewhere else. You don't want the two getting in the way of each other.
That's really interesting. Okay, I'm going to see test pits in a completely different light. And Helen mentioned the work that Carenza has been doing in the village of Norton Disney. There is a podcast episode about Norton Disney, by the way, where Carenza explains a lot more about that process, and you get to meet the people who are working on the test pits in that village and what they're trying to understand. If you scroll back through all of the podcast episodes that we've put out, you'll find one, you know, called Norton Disney. You'll be able to see it, and that's where you'll be able to find loads more about test pits and the work that Carenza has been doing with them. Let's get to another question. This comes from Petra Kate, who has clearly been watching one of our recent Sutton Hoo videos, thank you for that, and asks, Helen commented that we know the bucket, so this is the Byzantine bucket that was discovered in a previous Sutton Hoo dig, is from the 6th century, from the letter forms. What is it about the letter forms that gives us that hint? You're going to have to start by explaining what a letter form is, I think, Helen.
Oh, okay, yes. No, if you think about how you might date a book that you were reading, you might well look at the forms that the letters take. So at the moment, we tend to like sans serif. In the medieval period, you might have seen black letter, which is really, really, you know, the Gothic lettering that's really, really hard to understand, to read. It's really difficult to make head or tail of. Now, on the Broomswell bucket, we've got writing in Greek, and the Greek letter forms vary over time. The specific things that have given us this 6th century date are the omega, which is like a W, and the chi, which looks like an X. Now, the omega, the curves of the W are actually separated slightly, so it does look literally like two U's, and that's known as a broken omega, found on buckets with and other objects that have independent dates. So they might refer to a person with dates, or they might have coins soldered to them that give you a date, or whatever. Dated inscriptions from the 6th century have a broken omega. Also, we have the chi, which should just be a cross, is tilted slightly. It's lent over one way. And that is another thing that is found on dated inscriptions. And they both join together. They both add up to the same moment in the past, which is the middle of the 6th century. It's a process of looking at an inscription with a date, looking at it really, really carefully, working out what makes those letter forms different to the standard, and then seeing if you can find them anywhere else. So in a way, we've just been really, really lucky that we've got an inscription that includes those distinctive letters.
It's almost related to what we were talking about with Rob earlier, language and etymology, and how that can be used to help our understanding of the past. But this is actually, you know, the actual style of the letters that were printed on things allow us to get a date because of when they were popular. That is very, very interesting. Great question. Thank you so much, Petra Kate. If you want to ask a question, it couldn't be easier. You go to Patreon and you click on Ask Us a Question. It's there under chats. So just go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial, and that's where you'll see everything that you need to ask a question on a future edition of the podcast.
And don't forget, the final episode of our time at Sutton Hoo last year comes out on Saturday. We can't wait for you to see it. Speaking of which, the next time you see us here on YouTube, we'll be on site at Sutton Hoo, bringing all of the behind the scenes updates from the heart of the action this year.
Yeah, we are so looking forward to that. So whether you're watching or listening, we'll catch you again on another edition of the Time Team podcast.